Okay, friends, in this second lecture, we are going to focus on a single sermon of Jonathan Edwards that he once preached in Northampton. But the importance of this sermon is that he lays out what I believe he understood what theology really is. The nature of theology, the essence of theology, and he lays it very clearly out in this sermon. So, I begin with a quote that goes like this. Edwards drew the common distinction between two kinds of theological knowledge. The first, speculative, and the second, practical. The aim of Edwards' theology was to nurture a sense of divine things that took one deeper into their nature than the speculative understanding alone could penetrate, and to guide and influence us in our practice. Thus, Brooks Holyfield in Theology in America. Although Holyfield asserts that Edwards' aim and distinction of theology may have been indebted to the Reformed scholastic Petrus van Maastricht, many in Edwards' scholarship on the theology of Edwards, such as Riddebos, Cherry, Gerstner, Holmes, Lee, have overlooked such indebtedness, which may be the underlying and overarching theme in the interpretation of the nature of Edwards' theology. One reason for such oversight is that many in Edwards' scholars and many of Edwards' sources remain in untranslated Latin. As Amy Plantinga Powell points out, following Norman Feiling, that many Edwards' scholars don't know Latin. Another reason may be, as Jerry McDermott recently remarked, more scholarly work needs to be compared Edwards with European thinkers and issues, and thereby include him in the ongoing discussion of international philosophy and theology. And therefore, this lecture attempts to evaluate Edwards' theological inquiry by a more in-depth view of Protestant scholasticism and its trajectories. And I will focus on a single document wherein Edwards most distinctively, I think, lays out his understanding of the nature of theology. A sermon of November 1739, that is just prior to the so-called Great Awakening, that started in the 1740s, November 1739, published as The Importance and Advantage of a Thorough Knowledge of Divine Truth. Here you have the title. And the sermon can be found in a sermon booklet that was printed in Edinburgh as well. The period 1737-1742 was a challenging and changing time for New England's history. War, the French-Indian Raids and the War of Jenkins' Ear, and the Awakenings shaped Americans' early history and theology in unprecedented ways, in particular following the Great Awakening, which event is fixed to that towering figure in intellectual history, Jonathan Edwards, a preacher, a theologian, a philosopher, a missionary, a pastor, and a university president. Though steeped in 17th century English Puritanism and continental post-Reformation Reform thought, New England's theological orthodoxy and practice were put to the test during these years of 1737-42. The rise of Arminianism, the dissemination of deism, and the news about the new Methodists, such as John Wesley and George Whitefield, all contributed to the division and realigned alliances in the British colony. The concern over the Arminianism was expressed in a letter, for example, a letter exchange in March 1739 between Captain Benjamin Wright and the Reverend Benjamin Dolittle of Northville, Massachusetts. Dolittle accused his parishioner Wright of having signified nothing of a desire of peace and love, while Reichardt, his pastor, had often advanced Arminian principles both in the pulpit and in private conversation. The danger of deism was not only generally known in New England, but the congregation of Northampton in particular was, thanks to their pastor, well versed in it. In Sermon 24 of the History of the Work of Redemption series of the mid-1739, Edwards warned, I quote, again another thing that has of late exceedingly prevailed among Protestants, especially in England, is deism. The deist wholly cast off the Christian religion and are professed infidels. They are like heretics, like Arians, like Socinians and others. They deny any revealed religion and say that God has given mankind no other light to walk than by his own reason. End quote. Edwards was not an insignificant participant in these transformative years of New England, though based at the rural town of Northampton. His faithful narrative of a surprising work of God published in London in 37 and in Boston in 38 had placed Edwards in the emerging network of transatlantic evangelical community. And his preaching on the various discourses, such on the parable of the wise and foolish virgin in January to April 1738, and the series of 1 Corinthians 13, later published as Charity and Its Fruits, and the sermons that became known as the History of the Work of Redemption, established him as an extraordinary preacher. However, it is precisely in these taxing years for New England's theology that Edwards evolved as a theologian par excellence, historically informed and contemporary relevant. It is important to note that the pastor of Northampton did not publish a systematic theology, as we just saw in the former lecture. Did not publish a systematic theology like the post-Reformation Reformed theologians François Turretin and Peter van Maastricht, or like his 18th century proteges Joseph Bellamy and Samuel Hopkins. Edwards commented on his predecessors, whose work a leading example of 17th century Protestant scholasticism joined with piety. Edwards writes, they are both excellent, Turretin and Maastricht. Turretin, he writes, is polemic divinity on the 5 points and all other controversial points, and is much larger in these than Maastricht. And it is better for one that desires only to be thoroughly versed in controversies. But take Maastricht for divinity in general, for doctrine and practice and controversy, or as a universal system of divinity, systematic theology, it is much better than Turretin or any other book in the world except the Bible, in my opinion. Edwards' generous praise was an echo of earlier praise, commencing with Colin Mather, who wrote in a handbook for students in Boston, for students studying in the ministry in his Maleductio ad Ministerium, Colin Mather writes, but after all, there is nothing that I can do. With so much pleasure, recommend you Maastricht, his Theologica Theoretica Practica. That a minister of the gospel may be thoroughly furnished into every good work, and in 1 or 2 quarto volumes enjoy this well-furnished library, I know not that the sun has ever shone upon a human composure than on Maastricht. In fact, Maastricht's work was highly valued by such well-known New England theologians such as Benjamin Coleman, Joseph Secombe, Maastricht's editor and translator on the chapter on regeneration, Samuel Hopkins and Joseph Bellamy. And Edwards and Mesa Park, so-called the last of the Edwardians, reported that Jonathan Edwards Jr. read Maastricht 7 times. I don't know if it's symbolic, but 7 times. In spite of, or thanks to Maastricht's work, however, the absence of a published form of systematic theology, or following the 18th century term, the body of divinity, in Edward's corpus, does not imply that no consideration was given to such a project. On the contrary, as early as 1724, Edwards drafted an outline for such a treatise entitled, what I mentioned also before, A Rational Account of the Principles and Main Doctrines of the Christian Religion. Though it seems that he abandoned this project after 1740, so after the Great Awakening, the thought of composing a body of divinity of a systematic theology never left him, as he attests in a letter of 1757 to the trustees of the College of New Jersey, now called Princeton University. I had it in my mind and heart to write a great work which I called The History of the Work of Redemption, a body of divinity in an entirely new method being thrown in the form of a history considering the affair of Christian theology. Maastricht, the favorite theologian of New England, and Edwards in particular, prefaced his Theoretica Practica in 1699 with very similar words. I had planned for long a great work about the adventures of the church and provide a particular sketch about the history of the church dealing about the dispensations of the covenant of grace through all the ages of the church. Moreover, in the tumultuous years of 1737 and 42, Edwards drafted at the close of 1739, around the time of the preaching of the sermon, he drafted a preface to the Rational Account, wherein he mentions some things may have justly made us suspect that the present fashionable divinity is wrong. He was so concerned about the rise of Arminianism. Finally, and precisely at that time, Edwards not only included in one of his sermon notebooks a sketch of the homily on Hebrews 5 verse 12, but also preached an extensive treatment on the text in November 1739 at Northampton, posthumously published as The Importance and the Advantage of a Torah Knowledge of Divine Truth. Maybe the first one. So the text of Hebrews 5 verse 12, which you can read in the King James Version, the version that Edwards used in the pulpit and in his study and his family. What is suggested here is in these times of New England's contested theology and its practice, Edwards emerged as a prime example of effectively communicating the fundamentals of Christian theology, Catholic in its trajectory, contemporary in his setting. And therefore, a brief analysis with historical theological commentary of this homily, both in structure and content, is required to discern Edwards' position in this transitional moment of theology. In regard to the structure, maybe the next one. That is the historical context of the sermon. In regard to the structure, Edwards' sermon on Hebrews 5 verse 12 is a literary unit, most likely divided in two preaching occasions. Most likely in the morning he preached on the first part of the sermon, and in the evening he preached the second part of the sermon. But the sermon is comprised of three main divisions: text, doctrine, and application, of which the latter is presented as uses and directions. Wilson Kimnack, an Edwards scholar, convincingly argued that Edwards relied upon the basic structure and general rationale of the 17th century Puritan sermon form. However, the form of the discourse may further have been strengthened by Edwards' profound acquaintance of Maastricht's Theoretica Practica Theologica, that presented each loci of the Reformed theology in a fourfold but integral manner: exegesis, doctrine, elenctic, and praxis, the latter also containing uses and directions. In particular, Maastricht's work was written not only for the study of theology, but also intended for the preparation of a sermon. In addition to the threefold division of the discourse, Edwards offered in the doctrinal section a sketch in sketch and published form four propositions or questions. So this is the text, maybe the next. It's the structure of the sermon. Maybe next one. It's the structure, the sermon structure, exegesis. It's a contextual exposition of Hebrews 5 verse 12. The doctrine, for Edwards, doctrine arises out of scripture. And then the application with exhortation and directions. The exhortations, he gives very practical applications and instructions to his congregation. Directions that he gives to his congregation. And then the sermon aim. Practice according to what knowledge you have. This will be the way to know more. And then we come to the questions. Edwards offers in the doctrinal section, in sketch and published form, four propositions or questions. First, what divinity is. Second, what kind of knowledge in divinity is intended in the doctrine. Three, why knowledge in divinity is necessary. And four, why all Christians should make it a business endeavoring to grow in this knowledge. So what divinity is, what kind of knowledge in divinity is intended, what knowledge of divinity is necessary, and why all Christians should make it a business of endeavoring to grow in this knowledge. Those are the four questions that he posed in the doctrinal section of the sermon. Yes, thank you. The informed reader notices immediately Edwards' sophisticated approach to the theological discourse by raising medieval scholastic questiones. Quid sit, what is, quale sit, what sort, and quanta sit, how great. These particular rhetorical distinctions, acknowledged by Edwards as an examination, I quote, according to the rules of arts, unite Edwards' sermon structure with the method of theological inquiry of post-Reformation Reformed thinkers such as Maastricht and other Protestant scholastics such as Beza, Zanke, and Gerhard, but also with medieval intellectuals such as Lombardus, Aquinas, and Scotus. In summary, the structure of Edwards' exposition on the knowledge of divinity, or theology proper, then can be characterized as the Methodus Theologica and is thereby placed in a long-standing trajectory of the development of the systematic of theology. This observation is further underscored by examining the content of the first question, the quid sit, stated in Edwards' sermon notes as what we mean by divinity, what we mean with theology, what we mean with systematic theology. And in the published text, what divinity is. Maybe the next. No, okay. One back, please. Thank you. Concerning the question what divinity is, Edwards provides first a general statement. Divinity, theology, he asserts, is that science or doctrine which comprehends all those truths and rules which concern the great business of religion. From an historical theological perspective, one would recognize Edwards' ambivalence at this point in the discourse. Does he mean that divinity or theology is a scientia or a doctrina? Does Edwards take a Thomistic position on the formulation of theology as primary over the other sciences? Such seems the initial direction that the Northampton preacher takes when he writes, there are various, and I quote from the sermon, there are various kinds of arts and sciences taught and learned in the schools, which are conversant about various objects, about the works of nature in general, as philosophy, natural philosophy, or the visible heavens as astronomy, or the sea as navigation, or the earth as geography, as the body of man as physics and anatomy, the soul of man with regard to the natural powers and quality, as logic and phenomenology, about the human government as politics, but there is one science, Edward says, there is one science or one certain kind of knowledge and doctrine, which is above all the rest, as it is concerning God and the great business of religion, this is divinity. Furthermore, this Thomistic thought seemed to be enforced by Edward's third question about the necessity of the knowledge of divinity. Corresponding with Aquinas' opening inquiry in the Summa Theologica on the necessity of the nature and extent of sacred doctrine. The perceptible Thomistic quality in Edward's view of theology, however, is modified in considering his observation, quote, there are two kinds of knowledge of divinity, speculative and practical, or in other terms, natural and spiritual. This observation is not only of great importance to the preacher of Northampton, giving the attention to doctrine and application section of the sermon to his inquiry, but also places Edward both in a long-standing trajectory of scholastic inquiry whether theology is a science, scientia, or is a wisdom, sapientia, as well as the discussion of the scholastic distinctions both present in medieval and Protestant scholastic system of theology. With the rise of interest in the 13th century in Aristotle's writing, the discussion of the nature and the extent of theology was formed in part by the philosopher classification of forms of knowledge, science and wisdom, scientia, sapientia. Franciscans, such as Alexander of Hales, Bonaventure, insisted on the effective, practical, experiential character of theology, excluding it from the consideration as scientia in the Aristotelian sense of a rational or speculative discipline. Aquinas, on the other hand, not only argues in the Summa Theologica known to Edward during his studies at Yale College, that sacred doctrine is a science. But also Aquinas raises the question whether sacred doctrine is a practical science, to which Thomas, reflecting the Dominican theology, replied, it is not a practical, but a speculative science. These Farley broad outlines of the character of theology find their culmination in Duns Scotus in the 13th century formulation of theology. Scotus not only resonated with the Franciscan theology, though integrated a more Aristotelian philosophy than previously was accepted, but considered theology as a discipline oriented toward the ultimate goal of humanity in God. In essence, practice. That is to say, a knowledge not only known for itself, but a knowledge that is gained and is directed to God. And this medieval discussion on the character of theology, expository to the matters of faith, whether theology is theoretical or practical, would resurface in the 16th and 17th century works of Roman Catholic and Protestant theologians. In respect to the Roman Catholic theologians, Dominicans such as Domingo Bagnier and Melcho Cano and Granada de Louis reach back to the formulation of Aquinas on the essence of theology, while Jesuits such as John Gibbons and Francisco Suarez, who was also praised by Edwards as the best of the schoolmen, tended to present the scholastic argument from both the Scotus and the Thomistic tradition, where the practica was not rejected altogether, but opted for a modified Thomistic position. While the Franciscans sided with Duns Scotus and positioned the practical nature of the Theologica Viator. Important notion. The medieval theologians understood Christians are pilgrims on the way. A Christian is a pilgrim on the way to the heavenly Jerusalem. And on the way, God revealed knowledge to us. So that is the Theologium Viatorum, the theology on the way. It's a pilgrim theology. Concerning the Protestant theologians, Lutherans, for example, Johann Gerhard and Balthasar Meiser and George Calix and Quenstedt, as well Reformed thinkers such as Martin Bucer and Sybrand Lubettus and Keckerman and Musculus and Vermigli of the 16th century, moreover with the Reformed theologians of the 17th century such as Trigland and Kloppenburg and Coxeus, Horenbeek, Leidecke, Amarc, recognized theology as a mixed discipline, both theoretica and practica, though leaning towards the practica, but rejecting its anthropological character as proposed by the Remonstrants. What I mean is here, the Remonstrants, they say, theology is only practica, and it depends on the human will to use your knowledge directed to God. The Reformed thinkers say, no, it's not dependent on the human will. It is dependent on the work of the Holy Spirit. Worked in the will, changes the mind and the will and the heart directed to God. However, Edwards' inquiry whether theology is speculative or practica was raised in particular in the prolegomena of Protestant scholastic theology of Maastricht and Turretin, theologians with whom Edwards was deeply acquainted. Turretin raised the question explicitly, is theology theoretical or practical? Inquiring not only about the understanding of the essence of theology, but also on the account of the controversies of his time, such as the Remonstrant and the Socinians, a concern that Maastricht shared as well. Turretin asserts, furthermore, that a theoretical or speculative system is occupied in the contemplation alone with knowledge as its object. So you gain knowledge for yourself. Contrary to the practical theology, which has its operation for its object, God, in view. And therefore, the Genevan theologian concludes, theology is neither theoretical nor practical, but is a mixed discipline, and yet more practical than speculative, which appears, Turretin explained, and I quote, from its ultimate goal, which is practice. Indeed, nothing in theology is theoretical to such a degree as so remote from praxis that it does not bring about the admiration and worship of God. Nor is a theory salvific unless it is referred to practice. In addition to Turretin's question whether theology is speculative or practical, Edwards' most favorite theologian, Maastricht, also discusses whether the discipline is theoretica or practica. Although he does not reject the Thomistic position altogether, Maastricht is inclined to follow a modified scholastic position on the issue, proposing that the praxis is defined as doctrina, known for the sake of the end toward which it directs the knower. So you gain knowledge so that it directs yourself through the work of the Spirit to God. In other words, Maastricht aims to maintain a balance between the speculative and the practica, expressed in the conjunction theoretica, conjunction practica, oriented towards the praxis. In summary, we note the reception and appropriation of older scholastic models by these post-Reformation Reformed theologians. The continuity of the inquiry and the formulation of the understanding of the character of theology in both the Roman Catholic and Protestant tradition shows the catholicity of the theological enterprise. The appropriation of the theological inquiry is specific for post-Reformation theologians such as Maastricht and Turretin, while the alternative model of theology offered by the Remonstrants or Arminians is fundamentally different, a rejection of the recognition of theology as a mixed discipline. Simon Episcopius, following Jacobus Arminius, had argued, quote, there is nothing in the whole of theology that is not directed to action. In other words, theology is not a speculative but fundamentally an anthropocentric drive to practice, which was a departure from the theocentric character of Reformed theology and prevailing for Edwards as well. Although Edwards' inquiry to the nature of theology stands in continuity with the Protestant and medieval inquiry, along with the attention to the scholastic distinctions such as speculative and practical, the quest remains, as Edwards phrased it, what kind of knowledge in divinity is intended. In the Sermon on Christian Knowledge, he begins to point out to the hearers at Northampton that the difference between having a right speculative notion of the doctrines contained in the Word of God and having a due sense of them in the heart does not imply that neither of these is intended exclusively to one another. But he declares, it is intended that we should seek the former, speculative, in order to the latter, practical. This is for Edward of great importance, as he reminds his hearers, a speculative knowledge of the Word of God without spiritual knowledge is in vain and has no purpose. Yet, speculative knowledge is also of infinite importance in this respect, that without it, we can have no spiritual or practical knowledge. We may infer from this that Edwards does not reject the speculative entirely, as he assigns significant importance to it. Seek, he counsels, a good, rational knowledge of the things of divinity. Yet, seeking the speculative comes not at the expense, but in support of spiritual knowledge or practice. In summary, we note the reception here of older Protestant scholastic models by Edwards. Not only is a similar inquiry on the nature of theology employed by the preacher of Northampton and post-Reformation Reformed theologians, but also a discerning on Edwards' part of the character of theology, following Maastricht more than Turretin as theoretica practica theology. And with that, Edwards positioned himself on the one hand in continuity with classical theology, rooted in post-Reformation, Reformed and the Franciscan scotistic tradition, and on the other hand over against his challenges, the Arminians and the Deists. His familiarity with Episcopius, identified by Edwards as one of the great Arminians and the Deists, such as Thomas Chubb, whose writing Edwards refutes later in particular, strengthened Edwards' point in defending the essence of theology in these transformative years in New England's history and theology. However, the appropriation of former models of Catholic and classic theology by Edwards provides a rather contemporized problem and prospect. In regard to the latter, Edwards assessed and equated deism of his time with the tendencies of Socinianism of previous centuries. Thus, he not only provided his vast knowledge of the post-Reformation systematic theology as an approach for assessing contemporary challenges and proposed changes, but this systematic theology also presented him with precise and nuanced definitions of the discipline, indispensable for the interpretation of events and formulation of his own view. Although Edwards carefully argued the importance and advantages of a thorough knowledge of divinity to his congregation in 1739, his argument continues to pose a challenge for the modern reader as well. The discourse, the sermon, is in a language other than Latin, the language of the post-Reformation and medieval sources. The continuity of intellectual trajectory of the theological language, definitions and distinctions from the medieval period to Edwards' studies at Northampton became instantly absent in translation to the great majority of his listeners. Not that his hearers in the pew would be aware of such, most probably, or that Edwards' message was deficient by it. However, the significance of Edwards as a theologian in these transformative years of New England may be lost as well, at least to most Edwards scholars. Therefore, the proposed understanding of this homily must be placed as a fundamental to our understanding of Edwards' theology and his much later published major works against Arminianism and deism, such as The Freedom of the Will and Original Sin, as his controversial notebook dating from the 1730s attest already. In conclusion, in the midst of these challenging and changing years of 1737-42, in New England's religious history, Edwards revisited fundamental questions of theological prolegomena. The formulation of his entries demonstrated not only continuity and discontinuity, but also a demanding appropriation of intellectual thought, that of the castellicity and classicality of theology. The discourse, the sermon, was drafted and heard in Northampton and published in 1788 and soon afterwards forgotten. Yet his message is timeless. Edwards closes his sermon, and we close this lecture, "Practice according to what knowledge you have. This will be the way to know more." Thank you.